What I want to start with today, I want to sketch the proofs of the two multiplicity one theorems for GLN. So I'll begin with multiplicity. One for GLN. And the statement of this is quite simple. It says that if you take pi v pi, just sort of, we'll make it an irreducible, admissible, generic, unitary representation of GLN. So this means, I'm trying to put down enough conditions here that it's potentially a cuspidal representation. I guess I want it to be smooth. Okay. Then, the multiplicity m pi of pi in the space of cusp forms. Say a infinity naught is at most 1. Okay, so if something occurs, it occurs at most once. And this is really just a consequence of the uniqueness of Whitaker models globally. That's really all this is. And so here's the proof. So suppose we have two realizations of this representation in the space of cusp forms. So it embeds in either as v pi 1 or and v pi 2. Okay? Everything inside the space of cusp forms. Okay, and if I take a vector here, it will then either go to phi 1 or phi 2. So these are the associated cusp forms. So phi 1 and phi 2. Associated to my vector C, which is a priori in this abstract representation. Okay? Well, then we immediately get two Whitaker functionals from this. Namely, I send C to one of the cusp forms, and then once I have a cusp form, we know what Whitaker functionals look like. You take the global Whitaker function and evaluate it at the identity. So I take W phi I, evaluate it at the identity, and that's lambda I of C. Okay? So I get these two Whitaker functionals coming from the two realizations in the space of cusp forms. But then by uniqueness, there exists a non-zero constant such that lambda 1 is C lambda 2. Okay? That's just the uniqueness of the Whitaker model or the Whitaker functionals. Okay? But then now we read things back. This tells us that if I look at W phi 1 of G, that's the same thing as lambda 1 pi G C. That's the way you recover the model from the functional. And by uniqueness, this is C lambda 2 pi G C, and that is, what do I have, constant. And then this is the way you recover the model from the functional, so this is W phi 2 of G. Okay. So you get that the two Whitaker functions have to agree. So that's the uniqueness of Whitaker models. And then the next thing we use is then the Fourier expansion. This cus form is the sum of its Whitaker function, gamma 0, 0, 1, g. And by this equality, this is constant times Whitaker function for the other cus form. And so this is a constant phi 2 of g. Okay, and the constant's non-zero. So if my two realizations, the intersection contains more than zero. It contains, well, phi 1 and phi 2. Okay. And so by irreducibility, these things are equal. They're just physically equal. Okay? So that's the multiplicity one. I started off with two realizations in the space of cus forms, and I showed that they had to be equal. The two things we used were the existence of the global uniqueness of the Whitaker model and the Fourier expansion. Okay? And this proof was basically realized simultaneously by Pitevsky Shapiro in Russia and Shalika in Baltimore, where he never leaves. GLN. What's the problem? This is, so gamma here is summed over n minus 1 k mod gl n minus 1 k. Yeah, this is on, it's GLN. Isn't that what I said? Yes. The Fourier expansion looks the same. Early 70s. I think Shalika's is 73. I think it was published in 73, and PS's was announced, was in this Budapest conference held in 71. Huh? No. I mean, not in this sense. I mean the, if you deal with this in terms of representations and things like this, Whitaker models, the statement of the uniqueness of Whitaker model locally at the Piatic places occurs in the same volume as the PS article.
Okay, so that's the problem.
Okay. And the global Fourier expansion on GLN occurs in the same volume for PS. And for Shalika, the existence of the Whitaker model and the Fourier expansion and multiplicity one are all in this one paper in 73. So no, this is all the ingredients here happened at the same time. And it was early 70s. You don't have a Fourier expansion for general groups. That's right.
But we do have a uniqueness here.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. You have a uniqueness of Whitaker model for general groups. But you, it's this. The Fourier expansion is extremely powerful. Okay. Now, not long after this, but for generic, it should be true. Okay, but in general, yeah, the multiplicity one's false. Okay, not long after this, Pietetsky Shapiro gave the first proof of strong multiplicity one for GLN based essentially on the same ideas. So let me explain that. So here's strong multiplicity one. It says, suppose you have two cuspidal representations. Of GLN. Okay? And suppose, well, so these decompose. So let's decompose each one of them into its local components. Okay? And suppose there exists a finite set places, such that for all V outside of S, we have that these two representations look the same locally. So pi 1V is isomorphic to pi 2V. Okay? So locally they look the same almost everywhere. Then the conclusion is that in fact these are exactly the same. And I'll just write it this way. I.e. pi 1V is isomorphic to pi 2V for all V in S as well. Okay? And now once I have them equal at all, isomorphic at all V, then I just apply multiplicity 1 to get this sort of physical equality here. Okay. The idea... Did this thing start to slip again? Okay. So the idea is very similar. But it uses, instead of using the, it still uses the Whitaker model in an essential way, but it uses a slight variant of it called the Kirilov model. So let me explain the Kirilov model a little bit. So just like when we did the Whitaker models, we sort of analyzed them locally and then put things together to get global statements. We're going to do the same thing here. So let's let pi v, v pi v, be, and well, let's see. It's going to be a constituent of those. So let's see. It's going to be irreducible, admissible, smooth, generic's important. Do I use, I don't really use unitary, but, well, let's just leave it at that. Representation of GLN over a local field. Okay? So it's generic, so let's let W pi V psi V be its Whitaker model. Okay? Now remember, inside GLN, this contains this group that we've been calling the Mirabolic subgroup. So its last row is all zeros with a 1. And if you like, it's the stabilizer in GLN of this vector when you let GLN act on row vectors. Okay, so this is the Mirabolic. It is amazing what a big role the Mirabolic plays in the representation theory of GLN. And the lack of something analogous in the other groups is also something which hinders one a little bit. And unfortunately, since I'm not giving full details of proof, we won't see the role it, we won't see all the details of the role it plays. But here's, this at least will give you some idea, maybe. So there's the Mirabolic subgroup that sits inside GLN. And you can take these functions, you can take the functions in the Whitaker model, and you can just restrict them to this group. So consider, for W in the Whitaker model, consider the restriction as functions to the Mirabolic subgroup sitting inside GLN. Okay. And the first amazing theorem is that, in fact, the map WV to W restricted to the Mirabolic, so in other words, here I'm looking at a function evaluated on the group, and here I'm looking at the same function evaluated on this smaller group, This is actually injective. I.e., if WV is not zero, then WV evaluated at P is not identically zero. Okay? So when I restrict the functions to this Mirabolic subgroup, you don't lose anything. Okay? And this is due to Bernstein-Zelovinsky. If the place is finite, and Jacquet and Schleicher, if the place is infinite. Okay. And then the Kirilov model is the resulting space of functions. So the Kirilov model of pi is the resulting space of functions on the Mirabolic. So it's usually denoted K, and it's the set of all W, V, PV, such that W, V is in the full Whitaker model. And this you can analyze. You can either still think of it as a representation of G, of GLN, where the Mirabolic acts by right translation, and then the things that are in G that are in the Mirabolic, they act by, you have to transfer the structure from the Whitaker model down. Or you can naturally analyze it as a representation of the Mirabolic itself, and that's what one usually does. Now, another amazing fact is that independent of pi, these all contain a very large common sub Tn module. Namely, I'm going to call it tau, and it's either the compact induced module from the group of translations up to the Mirabolic of the character. So this is compact induction. This is what it is if the place is finite. And this is, of course, Bernstein-Zelovinsky. And if at an infinite place, what you do is you take unitary induction from the translations up to the Mirabolic. And then, since I think everything I'm doing is smooth, I think I have to take the smooth part of that, and this is if V divides infinity, and this is Jacquet-Schleicher. Okay? So this thing sits inside all of those, no matter what pi is. Okay? It's got this big common submodule. Okay? I should point out, well, no, I won't point that out. Okay, so it's got this big thing sitting inside there. Okay, so there's always something in common here. Okay. All right, so we have to use these two facts. And at the time that Piotrowski-Shapiro proved this theorem, he had these facts for the finite places. Okay. And so you have to keep this in mind here. And so n is always the maximal unipotent subgroup, sorry. It's always the full group of translations, the maximal unipotent. Okay, so here are the steps for proving strong multiplicity one. And once you have these two facts in hand, it's actually fairly simple. The first thing, well, so what we want is, again, we want to construct some function phi in the intersection of these two cuspidal representations, okay? Some non-zero thing in common, because then we'll use irreducibility again to say that they're equal. Okay? Okay. So that's what we're after. Now, the first step, and this is a quite interesting thing, is to notice that if we let P prime be the parabolic times the center, so this is the parabolic associated to speak to me. Oh, that partition. Okay, so I put something in here, so I have a nice group. Then if you look at this quotient, this sits inside GLNK mod GLNA. This is where our cusp forms live, and in fact, this is dense. Turns out this is dense. The quotient of GLN mod P prime is P1, and the P1K is dense in P1A. But this is dense, and so it suffices to find phi 1 and phi 2 such that phi 1 P prime is phi 2 P prime for P prime in here. Okay? So I use this density to say, well, all I really need to find is a pair of functions that agree when I restrict them to this subgroup. Okay? So that's the first step. Okay. I'll leave this statement up there. Well, these things have topologies. It means it's dense. It basically comes, like I said, from the fact that if you take the quotient of this by this, then you get P1. Yeah. This, I just erased it. The mirabolic was the stabilizer of this vector. So if I take G mod the mirabolic, I get the affine space, and then when I quotient, I get P1. Or maybe it's PN. I guess it's PN. And then in a projective space, the rational points are dense than the idyllic points. So it's that. Okay. Yeah, I guess it's PN and not P1. Okay, so that's the first, is to use this density. Okay, and then my functions here, these are smooth, so these are continuous. So that will give me the equality. And then using the Fourier expansion, as before, it really suffices to find two Whitaker functions such that the Whitaker functions agree. Right? Because if the Whitaker functions agree, then when I sum them up, the cusp forms agree. That's exactly the same sort of argument we used before. Okay? Okay. Now, it turns out, since pi1v is the same as pi2v for almost all v, this is enough to force, either by an old argument of Hecke or by sort of weak approximation, that these two representations have the same central character. Okay? Forces the central character to agree. And now remember, P prime is the mirabolic times the center. And so if I know these things have the same central character, then it's going to be enough to show that I have two Whitaker functions that agree on the mirabolic. W1 at P is equal to W2 at P for P now not in the parabolic but in the mirabolic. Okay? Well, now I should be about done because if I'm worried about I'm looking at Whitaker functions restricted to the mirabolic. And if you think about what these statements say, it says I've got a lot of stuff in there. Okay, so the final step is that for places not in S, pi1v and pi2v are isomorphic, means they have the same Whitaker model, and so when I restrict them to the mirabolic, they have exactly the same Kirilov model. So the Kirilov model, pi1v, these two things are just equal. For V in S, well, I don't know what I know about these two representations. I don't have anything linking them other than the fact that they both contain this, and this is large. It's big infinite dimensional space. So here I have tau psi V is contained in K1V. Oops, K. It's contained in their intersection. Because it doesn't care what the representation is. It's in anything as long as it's generic. So, let's take W is equal to W1 equal W2. Anything in, I take the product over V and S, tau psi V, and then the restricted product, V not in S, K, either one. This is something contained in K pi 1 psi intersect K pi 2 psi. Well, this is the global Kirilov model. Okay? And so that's what I needed. That is a common Whitaker function. So I have something in the Whitaker model for one and the Whitaker model for the other that agree on the mirabolic. And now you just piece it back up. Or retrace to get phi and V pi 1 intersect V pi 2. Okay. So it's essentially the same argument that we used before, augmented by using the Kirilov model instead of the Whitaker model. Okay. Now, to be honest, if you go back and you look at PS's original statement, he had to require that for GL2, he had this in general. For GLN, he had to require that the set of places was that you left out were non-Archimedean places, because he only had this result at the non-Archimedean places. Once Jacquet and Shalika proved these statements at the Archimedean places, the same proof works. So later on, we'll give another proof of strong multiplicity one based on L functions, okay, which is the one that most people now remember. And so they often credit this to Jacquet and Shalika, but the original proof, at least with the restriction on S, is this, and it works the same way as multiplicity one. So. And I wanted to go through this because in some sense it may be one of the few chances I show you where we use the representation theory of the Mirabolic subgroup in the Kirilov model. And this is a statement about representations of this group of the Mirabolic subgroup. Okay, because this is as representations for the Mirabolic that it has this. And they look, they all, no, I don't know that that's necessarily true, but it's easy to say what they are. They basically look like, in general, the representations of the Mirabolic look like the following. Inside the Mirabolic, you take a GLM, and zero down here and stuff up here. Okay? You take this subgroup. On this, you put a representation, and then here you put characters, and you induce it up. Okay, you induce it up to the Mirabolic, and that's basically what the representations look like. Okay? Yeah, these are all local results. Yeah, these are all local results that I'm talking about. Mm-hmm. And so they're all associated to representations of GL, of some GL. And in fact, one way of analyzing, at least p-adically, the representations of GLN is to restrict them to the Mirabolic, decompose them, okay, which means you get a composition series where the quotients, the irreducible pieces of the quotients, look like this. And to each representation of GLN, you can then associate these representations of smaller GLs. Those are the Bernstein-Zelovinsky derivatives of the representation. And one way of analyzing representations of GLN are to analyze these. Okay? And now, yeah, it's just like here. Yeah, I put the same characters, just like here. So in particular, this is one of those, where I take the Borel. Okay? That's one of those. And what you prove is that for generic representations, when you restrict to P and do the decomposition, this always sits at the bottom of the filtration. And then you may have some other things along the way. And yeah, those are the Bernstein-Zelovinsky derivatives. And that's one way of analyzing either representations. You can analyze local L functions in terms of those also, etc. But that's what they look like. They're all sort of induced. It's sort of Mackey theory. Okay. Okay. So now it's time to eventually begin with integral representation. L functions. So we're really now, in some sense, starting the theory of L functions. So I'm always going to have two representations, pi v pi, this is going to be a cuspidal representation of GLN. And they're always going to be smooth. Okay? And so I want to understand the L function for this. And in general, I want to take something for a second GL. And understand the twisted L functions, okay? Which either we've seen these in Bayes converse theorem for GL2, and Ram Murthy has written these down in the classical context, these twisted L functions, Rink and Silber. I want to understand these. That's my goal for the next, probably month or so, is to try to understand these. Now, I want to point out two things before I begin. One is, the integrals that I'm going to write down are going to involve functions, and the functions I have floating around are the functions in these two spaces. These are huge infinite dimensional spaces. I'm going to write down a lot of integrals. At the end of the day, I only want one L function out. So this is a little bit different than classical theory. Okay? I'm going to have families of integrals, and I want a single L function. So that's one thing to note. The other thing to note is different from what happened classically with Hecke. He analyzed the L functions and then proved Euler product. For what I'm going to do, I'm actually going to want to see Euler product on the level of integrals. Okay, I want the integrals themselves to factor. That didn't happen for Hecke, but I want that to happen here. And that's not unreasonable, as I said, because these are irreducible representations, they factor themselves by the decomposition theorem. So I'm actually looking not just for integral representations, but for Eulerian ones. Okay? All right. That being said, I now go back to what I know, which is Hecke. And maybe filtered a little bit through Tate's thesis if I've read a little bit of that. And so I want to start with GL2. Twisted by GL1. Okay? All right. So now pi v pi. This is going to be a cuspidal representation of GL2. And I want a cuspidal representation of GL1. GL1 is just the multiplicative group. So let me take chi, just an Edel class character. So this is, if you like, is a cuspidal. Cuspidal doesn't mean much here. So it's just an irreducible unitary representation of GL1. And yes, I do want everything to be unitary. That's not an essential restriction, but it will let me normalize things about as to where things converge and things like that. So I'm going to take everything to be unitary. Now, what did Hecke do? Well, the integral that Hecke wrote down for a classical cusp form was the integral from 0 to infinity, f of iy, y to the s, b cross y. And if I write this in terms of the action of SL2 or GL2 on the upper half plane, I can write this in this way, acting on I. There's Hecke's integral. Okay? Just the Mellin transform of a cusp form. Okay? And so for us, we're going to write down exactly the same thing. So for each cusp form in the space of this representation, we consider I, S, V, K, chi, and it's going to be, I'm just going to write this integral down. So the analog of 0 to infinity is integrating up the edels, mod the principal edels, phi a 0, 0, 1, chi of a, absolute a. I'm going to put in a little bit of little normalization there. There's my integral. Okay? It's just, I just take Hecke and I write it in this idyllic world. Okay? Now, the cusp form's rapidly decreasing, and so from the rapidly decreasing, the fact that the cusp form is rapidly decreasing, you can almost immediately, just by looking at this thing, derive the following proposition. First, I take s minus a half because what that's going to do at the end of the day is give me a functional equation that relates s to 1 minus s. That's really what that's for. It'll be probably. Yeah, I don't know. I never thought about it. But yeah, that's basically to give me a s to 1 minus s functional equation. Okay. So the first thing is this is absolutely convergent. For all s. Okay? That comes from the rapidly crease of this guy. So the situation is a little bit different, and hence it's entire. Now, once I know this thing is entire, that it absolutely converges everywhere, if I slap on absolute values, the only place, so this, when I slap on absolute values, this becomes real part of S, and so the size of this function only depends on the real part of S. And so it's bounded in vertical strips, because in a vertical strip, the real part of S is bounded. So it's bounded in vertical strips. And finally, if I just then do the change of variable a goes to minus a, I get a functional equation. Okay? And the functional equation says I of s phi chi is I of 1 minus s phi tilde chi inverse. And I need to tell you what phi tilde is. Where phi tilde of a function g is phi evaluated at transpose g inverse. Okay, if I do transpose g inverse, that's the same thing as sending A to A inverse up there. But this is an action on this full space of functions. So I should note that phi tilde is still a cusp form. In fact, phi tilde is in the space of pi tilde, where pi tilde of G is pi of transpose G inverse. This is actually the contragradient representation. And so the functional equation really comes from the outer automorphism. G goes to either transpose G inverse, and I'm going to denote this by iota, this transpose G inverse, on, well, in this case, on GL2, but it's going to be the same thing for GLN. Okay. So I have at least, following Hecke's nose, written down a family of integrals. That's nice. These are the sorts of properties we were calling nice. Entire, bounded in vertical strip, functional equation. Okay? Just by doing what Hecke tells me to do. Now, I said I wanted these things to be Eulerian. which means I want it to factor into local things. And if you think about what we've done, it's pretty clear what you want to do to try to prove that these are Eulerian. I've said over and over and over that the cuss form phi itself does not factor. Now, the character factors and the absolute value factors and the product over the local places. The cuss form doesn't. The thing that does factor is the Whitaker function. We showed that as a consequence of uniqueness of Whitaker models. So if I'm going to have a shot of getting something to factor, I need to get the Whitaker function in there, and that uses the Fourier expansion. Okay? So to get an Euler factorization, we replace phi by its Fourier expansion. Okay, and so then we get I S phi chi is the integral up the Edels mod principal Edels, and the Fourier expansion is the sum gamma and k cross W phi gamma. Well, I would have gamma 0, 0, 1 times A 0, 0, 1. So let me just write it as gamma A 0, 0, 1. And then I have chi of A, absolute A to the S minus a half, D cross A. Okay? Now notice I have an integral A cross mod K cross, a sum over K cross. I want to unfold these. I have a gamma here. I can put a gamma here because this character is invariant. It's an Edel class character. It's invariant under K cross. There it is. And by the product formula, the absolute value of something in K cross is 1. So I can put K cross in here. So I put gamma here. So I put gamma here, unfold the whole thing. And I get the integral over A cross W phi A 0, 0, 1. Chi A, absolute A to the S minus a half, D cross A. And now I have to be a little bit careful. This thing's not a cuss form anymore. I have to worry a little bit more about convergence. I'll tell you the estimates about Whitaker functions as we go along. Right now, let me just say that this converges for real part of S bigger than 1. And the fact that this is 1 actually depends on my representations being unitary. So that's one place I'm using that sort of as a normalization. Okay, now everything, including the domain of integration, factors if the Whitaker function factors. So now, since pi is irreducible, it's a cuspidal, so it has a factorization. If phi is decomposable, i.e., so this is an isomorphism, phi goes to, say, product of cv in the restricted tensor product of the local representations, then we've seen that the uniqueness of Whitaker model then forces the Whitaker function to factor. You have to be a little bit careful, but that's all right. Okay. Once again, we're using that uniqueness of Whitaker model here. Now, also, chi A factors. This is just a fact about Edel characters, absolute value factors. So, our integral factors. Product over all places, integral now just over the multiplicative group of the local field. There is the local Whitaker function evaluated on the diagonal, character, local absolute value, and we'll write this as product over V. And this is the notation that Jacquet and Pierce and Chalaika use, is a psi V. I may have even used a psi there, I don't remember. But we'll call this psi V. I still have S, Whitaker function, local character. And this factorization is valid for the real part of S bigger than 1. Okay? So I in some sense, I've done what I wanted at this stage of the game for GL2 just by mimicking Hecke. Okay? I take Hecke's integral. It's nice. It has the analytic properties that I want. And it has an Euler factorization. Okay? That's what I was asking for at this stage of the game. So there's GL2, as Hecke would have done it. Okay. Well, we don't yet. That'll be in a couple of weeks. And in fact, they'll have denominators. I mean, they'll have numerators, most of them. Well, actually, I'm going to prove that I'll do the unramified calculation. No, for supercuspidal, I'll describe it. When I won't do it, those are a little bit, that would take us, we don't have quite that much time. Okay. Let's move on. Let's be ambitious and say we know what to do. Okay. So now let's look at GLN cross GLM in the case M less than N. Okay? So now I take phi and V pi, and this is cuspidal on GLN, and I take phi prime and V pi prime, and this is cuspidal on GLM, and I want to do exactly what I did before. Okay? Now, the first thing you might try is say, all right, well, let's look at this. Well, let me don't even give it a name yet. I don't want to give it a name because we're going to have to throw it away. If I just naively wrote down the analog of that, I might write down this. Some shift for normalization. And integrate. That was GL1A mod GL1K, and so this might be GLMA mod GLMK. That might be your first guess, and if you think about it, cusp forms are rapidly decreasing. I can probably prove this theorem about those integrals, and in fact, those are very nice, it turns out. Okay? On the other hand, if you go from there and you try to do this step, you'll find that those integrals are going to have a hard time being Eulerian because the Fourier expansions don't interact well. Okay? So these are nice, but not Eulerian. Unless things differ by 1. And when things differ by 1, you can do exactly this, and the world is great. If they differ by more than 1, this argument fails. So what we're going to do in that case, and what we do will recover the n minus 1 case, is we're going to have to somehow project the cusp forms down to something smaller, where in fact the ranks of the two things do differ sort of by 1.
So why does it work in the M?
Well, rather than do that, let me show you what we have to do and show you the argument that does work, and then when I'm doing it, I'll show you what would go wrong if we hadn't done. Okay? Well, it did for GL2, GL1. I mean, I may have to change it. Okay. Okay. So to get something, Eulerian, we first sort of project phi to a cusp form on, so phi is my thing on GLN, and so I might want to project it down to something on GLM, but in fact what I'm going to do is I'm going to project it down to a cusp form on the Mirabolic. My dear old mirror. Oh, except I want it. I want things to differ by one. So there we go. Okay, I'm going to project it down to there. In general, getting Eulerian integrals is just hard. It's not very scientific. It's more sort of. It's more creative. It's not easy to write them down in general. But for GLN times GLM, they're relatively simple. Okay. So the natural way to do this is the following. So let's consider the following subgroup. Y. It actually depends on N and M. And as matrices, it has the following shape. It's got an identity of size M plus 1 sitting here. One's here, arbitrary here, arbitrary here. Zero's here, zero's here. Okay. What this is, Y is the unipotent radical of the parabolic Q associated to the partition, well, M plus 1, 1, 1. Okay? That's really what that is. Notice that one thing it does, notice that it is an upper triangular, so it sits inside, again, that's that maximal unipotent subgroup. So that's going to be one ingredient of my projection. Note that since Y sits inside N, we can always restrict our character, sort of our Whitaker character that we always have floating around, the one that comes into the Fourier expansion. I can always restrict this to Y. Okay. So our character that we usually compute Whitaker models and Fourier coefficients with respect to, I can think of as a character, gives me a character of this group as well. And note that if we let M, so what's the Levy subgroup of this parabolic? Well, it's got a GL M plus 1 and then a bunch of GL1s. So if this is the Levy subgroup of Q, then I can ask what is the stabilizer in the Levy of not just this radical, because the Levy is the stabilizer of the unipotent radical, but I can also ask that it stabilize this character. Okay? And now what the character sees, right, if I take the character and restrict it to this group, the character sees the positions that are right above the diagonal. And so if I ask what in this group, when I conjugate, stabilizes not only this subgroup, but the character sitting there, you get exactly the Mirabolic subgroup sitting inside the GL M plus 1. Inside here. Okay, that's not a hard calculation. Okay? And now, so what my projection is going to be here, what I'm going to do is I'm going to have to, what I need to do is cut down my Fourier expansion a little bit is really what I'm trying to do here. So for my cusp form on GLN, and P is going to be in my mirabolic subgroup on Pn plus 1, sitting in as the levy of this parabolic set. So P phi, this is going to be a function on this mirabolic, the stabilizer of Y in this character. It's going to be, there's a normalizing factor, which is the determinant to the minus n minus m minus 1 over 2. And then I'm just going to do the integration. This is like taking a partial Whitaker transform, like taking a partial Whitaker function. I just take phi, and there's y, psi inverse of y dy. Right? If this was the full n, this would just be the Whitaker function. Okay? But I'm only integrating out part of this group of translations. And then here I have to put my p in. So p, and that's m plus 1 by m plus 1, so n minus m minus 1. All right? Still a compact integration, no problem with convergence. And the following proposition now is not that hard to prove. First is that this function is left invariant by the rational points, right? Because if I put a rational matrix here, it's going to just commute past because of this identity sitting there in Y, and then this is invariant under the rational points. Okay, so it's invariant by there, and in fact, cuspidal on the mirabolic, in the sense that all sort of the relevant unipotent integrals vanish. Because if I do a unipotent integration in here, I can sort of put that unipotent integration in with part of the unipotent integration coming from y without a character, and then use the cuspidality of phi itself to get that those vanish. So I really am sort of projecting down to cusp forms here. Okay. Of P. Yeah, this is a function on Pn plus 1. Yeah. Yes, it is. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's exactly the same. And I can combine those as part of the integration in this upper block here that doesn't have a character on it to manipulate things into giving me a full unipotent integration on phi. And so zero. That's what's happening. No, the character psi I pulled out of my pocket. This is our usual additive character that we always define Whitaker models and things like this with. I always carry it around and always forget to introduce it in the beginning, and I just sort of pull it out of my pocket when I need it. And of course, when I need it, I'm on a roll, so I just keep going. Now the second part, which is also not that hard, is that this has a Fourier expansion. And you can imagine how you prove it. You look at the n m plus 1 sitting inside p m plus 1, and you expand around the last column, and you then expand around the next column, expand around the next column, do exactly what we did before. And what you find out is the following thing, and this is the thing that's very important, that if I look at p of phi evaluated at a matrix of the form H1, just to make things easier, so this is in GLM, then this looks like, well, I still have my normalization, and then the sum, gamma n, n, m, k, mod GLM, k, Whitaker function of the full cusp form, gamma h, I, n minus m. That's it. That's it. Normally, I would have had more gammas and things in here. But remember, the thing that I started off expanding, I had already done part of the Whitaker integral to get to it. Okay? I had already integrated over this much of the unipotent radical with the character. And then when I go to Fourier expand in the rest of these variables, that picks up basically the rest of the Whitaker function. And so this is what you get. And now the thing here is, this is summed over exactly the kind of thing that phi prime is summed over in its Fourier expansion, and it's exactly the sort of thing that one could unfold against this, like we did before. Okay? So that's what I was after. And now, Now we're back to before. Okay, so now back to our previous paradigm. Okay, so we define set I, S, phi, phi prime. It's going to look like what I had written up before. MK, MA. But now I use my projected thing that has the nice Fourier expansion. Okay? So that's exactly what I would have written down from Hecker. And now remember, this is on m plus 1. This is on m, so they really do just differ by 1. And I've even arranged things. I've been sufficiently clever, which is a rarity, but sometimes it happens, to even make my normalization look the same, because I put a bunch of it over there in my projector. Yes? I'm doing more than that. I'm doing what Hecker would tell me to do. I'm following Hecker's nose. But no, I do not have an L function yet. No. I'm writing down integrals that are Eulerian. Okay? So yeah. If m is n minus 1, then I really don't have any integration. And p phi is just phi restricted to the Mirabolic, just like in the Kirilov model in some sense. Okay? So that's what this projection is in the case of m is n minus 1. I just restrict to the Mirabolic. And then this has me back Since this sits inside the mirabolic, it's really just that. Yeah. Well, I didn't, but that's just it. I didn't... Well, in some sense, I didn't lose any, because I've still got the full Whitaker function of phi sitting here. So in some sense, I haven't... So let's just say this way. I haven't lost anything that integration against something on GLM will see. Okay? And I've really sort of projected down to the part that's relevant for integrating against this. Okay? But I am somewhere down deep inside the structure of the representation. All right. Are we okay here? Did you have a question? Sure I do.
You're using an element in the function space here, the V prime space.
Yeah, but for GL1, all I have is a character.
The
function space for a character is just one-dimensional. There's nothing there. The only function in it is the character itself.
I'm just trying to figure out why there's a... I mean, there is a difference.
No. What I'm saying is that there isn't a difference because for GL1, GL1's abelian. An irreducible representation is one-dimensional.
Yeah.
So there's essentially only one function in there, and it is the character itself.
So phi prime is just chi.
Phi prime is chi.
A one-dimensional representation is just a
it's character.
Complex number, right?
Yeah.
But it's not a character, right? It's just an element in the space is just a number.
Well, but the group acts on it by a character.
So that's my distinction, right? So here you're actually taking a function, right?
Which yeah.
An element in the representation space.
Well, okay. It's a small thing,
yeah.
I hope.
That is a small thing, yeah.
Okay. But yeah, that's
it.
Yeah.
You recover the action of the center build thing. Well,
but I didn't have the action of the center of GL in the other one, GL2. Of the GL2, remember?
But, I mean, the
still... Oh, yeah, the center here. Yeah, the center survives here. Yeah, it survives here, but it's not central here because of the one. Yeah, center survives. Okay. So, yes. Yes. That's right. Well, it's hard to sort of find, but this is in the GL3 paper, Chuck APS Shalika. Yeah. Right, so already, if you can do it for GL3, then you can sort of figure out what to do. So it's in the GL3 paper, and a lot of the GL3 paper is written on GLN. So yeah, I think it occurs first there, yeah. No, because one I'm going to need for the following. Okay. So the first thing one has to prove is something about the analytic properties of these. And for the analytic properties of these, I really need to know that this is sort of cuspidal, so I can have things like rapid decrease. I have to worry about cusp forms on there. But it turns out one can prove, as before, with a little bit more work, because I have to worry about what I've done, but this actually converges. Absolutely. For all S. Actually, that's not too bad because this thing is still cuspidal. This is going to control a lot of stuff. It's the cuspidality of this. That's a cusp form. Since it's absolutely convergent, it's entire, and it is bounded in vertical strips, just as before. And there's a functional equation The functional equation is a mess. Part of it is exactly what one wants. It's 1 minus s. It's phi tilde prime. But now the integral itself is actually different. Okay? And so as before, phi tilde of g is phi of g iota, as in v pi tilde. Phi prime tilde is phi prime of h iota, and this is in phi tilde prime. And the integral is, in some sense, it's what it I mean, it's forced on you. Really, to get the functional equation, you take this, you do the transformation, h goes to transpose h inverse. Okay? That'll put phi tilde here, that'll put phi tilde here, that'll put transpose h inverse here, but I want to relate that back to transpose g inverse on phi itself, and going from the inside bit to the outside bit is this integration. And so I have to basically do whatever it has to do. And so what it is, it's what one would expect. It's this where, and here I'm going to be a little bit, well, what I'm writing is true, but it's, and it's sort of what has to happen, but you have to work out that it does. It's the new projection operator is the old projection composed with iota on both sides. So it says I take phi, I do transpose g inverse, then I do my unipotent integration, then I do transpose h inverse on what's left over. It's just what's forced on you. Okay. We'll see what that does a little bit later. But yeah, this is just coming from, just as before, it comes from h goes to transpose h inverse in this integral, and then you get what you get, and that's what you get. You have to use this different projection. Uh-huh. Well, it is, because I... Yeah, everything is just restriction to the mirabolic, and so I've restricted it, and I've done transpose inverse, basically. So, yeah, it doesn't affect it. Okay, and of course, now, fortunately, these integrals... What? Phi is in... What? I take phi. Right, I first do transpose g inverse on it. That gives me a new function. Then to that, I do that integration. Okay? Now, if you think about it, what that's done is, in some sense, doing transpose g inverse, that's taken that upper integration and made it a lower integration. Okay?
So you're using the same phi.
I'm using the same phi. No, well, no. So this is, I take phi, right? The first thing I do is I do iota. Okay? That means I replace phi... it means I replace phi by phi tilde. Okay? So it's... I take that as a function of g. I integrate with respect to that. Okay? Now, if I look at that on my original function, I'm taking y and I'm doing transpose g inverse to it, and that flips it down. So it's like doing a lower integration on my original phi. When I'm done with it, I still have something on... Well, it's sort of now on the lower nearbolic, but when I restrict it to H, that GLM is in common, and I just do transpose G inverse again. Okay, so it's really, it's really, you do transpose H inverse in that integral, and then you just, it's whatever you have to do, you do. And these integrals are now Eulerian. And here we go. We do exactly what we did before. All right, so this is the integral over the nearbolic. No, never mind. So we're GLM mod A mod GLM K, P phi H1 phi prime H, determinant H to the S minus a half. Okay. What did we do before? We replaced phi by its Fourier expansion. I now replace P of phi by its Fourier expansion. Here. Okay? So same integral. Well, I need to write it, unfortunately. So W phi. Oops. Sum gamma in GL NMK modding GLMK W phi. Now I've got it evaluated at H1, so I get gamma H I N minus M phi prime H absolute that H, and now I have S minus N minus M over 2 D cross H. Okay? Just by putting in the Fourier expansion. And now, as I noted before, now this Fourier expansion I can unfold against this integration. Okay? If I had just left with my phi without the projecting and tried to do this step, here I would be summing over everything up to GLN minus 1. And it's not going to unfold. Okay? So in some sense, all the stuff that I did was once again forced on me by knowing what I wanted here. Okay? So I unfold. As before, this is cuspidal. I can put gamma here. And determinant gamma is a rational thing, so it has absolute value 1. So I unfold. Okay, and when I do, I get the integral GLMA mod NMK W phi H I N minus M phi prime H absolute dot H S minus M over 2 dH. And now, once again, this is no longer rapidly decreasing. I have to worry about convergence. And I get real part of S bigger than 1 once again. Now, I'm not quite as well off as I was before because this doesn't factor yet. This factors, this doesn't factor, and this doesn't factor. Okay? So what I'm going to do is force at least this to factor by integrating over the adelic points of the translations. Okay? So all right. And then I have the integration over NMA mod NMK. Okay? Now, let me do two steps at once. When I put that N integration in here, right, so I put it here and I put it here, well, here, this is sitting inside the translations for GLN. This is a Whitaker function. It comes out with a character. Okay, so it spits out a character. So let me here, I'm just going to put and now here's my integration there's my character. That's the thing that lives from here. N is unipotent, it's determinant, it's one, it doesn't see that. Okay. And now what is this? That's the Whitaker integral for phi prime. That's exactly the Whitaker integral for phi prime. So this is really the integral of NMA mod GLMA, Whitaker function for phi at H, the identity, Whitaker function for phi prime. I'm going to put a prime there. I'll show you why in a minute. Well, I'll show you why right now, I guess. Because notice this. It is in the Whitaker model for pi prime, but it's for the inverse character. Right? Since I integrated against psi, it's going to kick out the inverse character. Okay, which is good because this will kick out psi inverse, this will kick out psi, and this is invariant under n, which it better be. And so now, if phi decomposes, and phi prime decomposes, right, then the Whitaker functions factor, and we're in business. And so I put this in, this now factors, this now factors, that now factors, and I get, not a theorem anymore, product over V, NMKV, GLMKV, Whitaker, CV, HV, identity N minus M, Whitaker prime, CV prime, HV, absolute determinant HV to the S minus M over 2, dHV. And these are my local integrals. S, W, CV, W, CV prime. And again, I factored in for real part of S. So in the end, I did exactly what I did for GL2. Okay, once again, well, this time it was partially y'all's fault. You asked me too many questions. I need to show you one more thing before I let you go. I still haven't done GLN cross GLN for you. I'll do that in 2 weeks' time. But I do need something that'll be crucial for what happens in the local theory, and that is, if you look at the functional equation that I have here, in this situation, the functional equation involved different integrals. What I've shown you is the left-hand side is Eulerian. Okay, it turns out with A, I have to put that in quotes. That's called a white lie. With a little more work, one shows the right-hand side of the functional equation is also Eulerian. Okay, so I tilde 1 minus S phi tilde prime. Turns out factors. Local integrals are again going to be different. 1 minus S. Right translation by a funny little vial element, W tilde. And this is going to be for the real part of S less than 0, because 1 minus S, that makes 1 minus S bigger than 1. And let me tell you what these things are. W and M, it's a funny vial element. It's got the M by M identity, and then it's got W, N minus M. W is always the long vial element, so it's M by M identity, and then this is the skew guy. That's what that funny vial element R is. R is right translation. These are what you would think they are. Well, if you think a little bit, it's what you think they are. So normally, when I put a tilde, that means I do transpose G inverse. But if I just do transpose G inverse, that flips upper unipotence to lower unipotence, and I've sort of got my unipotence not where I want them, so I put W in here. That's that long vial element. And this turns out is in the local Whitaker model for pi v, but I have changed the character to the inverse. Okay? Is there a question? So this is what it... Oh, that's a tilde, sorry. Flip the characters. But the interesting thing is, what's the integral? Because the integral has to see this guy, right? That's what's the difference in the global integrals, is the difference in the projections. And so what happens to this? And this is actually quite nice. So let me forget all the other stuff that goes in it. Just let me tell you what this is. Okay, so I flip back to S and without my tildes. So I still have an integral over GLM mod NM, just like I had here. Okay, but now I have a second integration. This integration is over a matrix space. It's over the full matrix space of size N minus M minus 1 M. And what it is I take WV, before I had just H there, and now, as we said, somehow when I did this, I took my unipotent integration and I flipped it down, and that's what stays. So there's an X here. So there's a full unipotent integration sitting here. And then everything else looks the same. So that's what the right-hand side becomes when you unfold it, and it is a little more than a little work to do that. It's a royal pain, if you want to know the truth. But you just do it, and that's what you get. So, as Jens pointed out, I don't have any L functions yet. So next time, the first thing I want to do is show you what happens with GLN cross GLN. Okay? I haven't shown you that yet. I have to do that. And then after that, what we're going to do is, for each pair of representations, I now have this huge family of local integrals. And what we want to do is somehow from these filter out a single local L function, a single Euler product, place by place. We'll do the non-Archimedean places. The Archimedean places, we'll do little calculations. But I'm going to figure out from those families of local integrals what the local L function is. Then I'm going to take the Euler product to get the global L function and then somehow relate that back to these global integrals that we know are nice and deduce the properties of the global L function from these global integrals. Okay? But yeah, it's going to be about a month before we see a global L function coming out of this. We're first going to do the local ones. So, anyway. Sorry. By the end of the term, I'm going to owe you probably about a month, all in nickels and dimes, but that's what can you do? You got to reach a stopping point. All right. Remember, next week is Shimura varieties, and they have asked that you go online and register if you're going to come to the Shimura varieties stuff. So please do that.